Well, thanks, Mike, for the introduction. I should actually just add, Gabriel Carle is here, and he was at Oxford as a postdoc while I was a student, and both things that I learnt in life, I came from him. So, the infinity puzzle, how to understand the universe led to extraordinary science, high politics, and the Large Hadron Collider, or from atoms to the LHC, how to win a Nobel Prize, but did you deserve it? If that's, that's a sub-theme to the book. Let me just give you the cast of characters. The state we're at the moment is with the Large Hadron Collider now just beginning, and the quest for the Higgs boson, if it exists, and many other things that we haven't dreamt of taking place. What the book really covers or focuses on is a group of scientists half a century ago who had the basic ideas which have today led to the current excitement around the Large Hadron Collider. There were two parts of this story. First of all, is a group of scientists who identified the basic ideas that unite the electromagnetic force and the weak force of radioactivity. And here they are, there's Weinberg and Glashow, and Ward and Salam. The problem is that only three people can share a Nobel Prize, and those are the three that won out, and Ward did not. And one of the core celebres in science has been whether Ward got a fair deal or not. So that's half of the story. The other half of the story was how to make the thing work at all, and that involves something which we call by various names, but I like to call the mass mechanism, not the Higgs mechanism, but the mass mechanism, a way to give mass to things that you didn't want to have mass in the first place. And Peter Higgs' name is associated with this as the father of the Higgs boson, which people are looking for. The problem, or a problem, is that there are six people who could lay claim to various aspects of this, known as the Gang of Six. And here they are in their passport photographs, and we will meet them along the way. And one of the impending future controversies, if a Higgs boson is found, might be how should the plaudits be shared out? And that's, again, one of the things that I address in the book. The Toft and Veltman, who have won a Nobel Prize already, without any question, hugely deserved, are the people who basically took, on the one hand, the ideas that Weinberg, Salam, Glashow, and Ward had done, combined them with the ideas of the Gang of Six to create the modern theory called quantum flavor dynamics that quantitatively describes the way that the forces work. And it was in getting rid of the horrible infinity that had been bugging the whole thing for years and years and years that the infinity puzzle of the weak force was solved by these gentlemen. Interestingly enough, I will not talk about them today, but in the book, I drew the analogy of what they did to climbing Everest. And I hadn't appreciated that this picture that Veltman chose when he had a photographer taking pictures of Nobel laureates, the photographer asked the laureates to include a drawing that they would like to be associated with. So a Toft here included a drawing of all the technicalities of the theory. Veltman just had a man or a person climbing up a mountain, which I thought was rather interesting, seeing as, unknowing to me, I'd use that analogy of him. The mountain analogy, however, comes in because there is one further person in this story who has not received recognition, which he deserves, in my opinion, and that's Bjorkane, who is shown here climbing a mountain. And we will see that, in my opinion, were it not for what Bjorkane did in the late 60s, that in practice, none of the experiments that we have been planning and hoping to interpret at the LHC would be possible. And for those of you who know these things, of course, there is only one title you could have for this picture. If you back off a little bit and show the whole picture, it's that. From that, I can deduce how many people are particle physicists in the audience. this picture, incidentally, the title was not mine. It was taken by Henry Kendall, who was one of the three who shared the Nobel Prize for the experimental discovery of the quarks. Dick Taylor, a well-known Canadian, being one of that three also, I remember, I have to add, in this country. Henry took that photograph himself. He was a great climbing buddy of BJ, as he is known, and he called it Bjorkane Scaling, which I thought was a nice title, and the picture's nice as well. Probably nicer than anything else in the talk, so let's move on. So I thought for the sort of general audience, just to give a little bit of background, I said from atoms to the LHC, to go right back to the very start, how the atomic nucleus itself was discovered. How do you discover anything? You look at it. You're seeing me because light is shining off me, and you're detecting it in your eyes. In the jargon, there's a beam, a target, and a detector. What Rutherford did, in fact, he didn't. His associates, Geiger and Marsden, did, but Rutherford, being the boss, got the credit, was to use a beam of alpha particles in natural radioactivity, fire them at a target of a little thin gold leaf, and from the scattering, which was detected on a small screen of scintillators, deduced the atomic nucleus was there, a story that everybody has heard. But what I hadn't appreciated was the genius that Rutherford exposed. You're not intended to see this, to be able to read it. Just note that these are just two pages of writing. These are the two pages that Rutherford wrote when he discovered the concept of what we now call the atomic nucleus. Years ago, I went to the Cambridge University Library, where Rutherford's papers are stored, expecting to find a leather-bound notebook with, you know, Ernest Rutherford, Lord Rutherford of Nelson, OM, FRS, blah, blah, blah on the front. I was given two sheets of paper written in pencil. And that's what these are. And it's the moment he discovered the nucleus. And you don't need any maths in this, or math, because you do it more simply over here, don't you? Math. This is an example of the man's genius. He was firing alpha particles, which are positively charged, at atoms, and the positive charge of the atomic nucleus was repelling the alpha particles, because like charges repel. We all know that he spent a lot of time working out how far they bounce, but the critical thing is that his genius was to realize that occasionally they bounce right back. So if you can imagine this here being the atomic nucleus and me being an alpha particle zooming in towards that, far, far away from that, the total energy that I have is kinetic energy, energy of motion, half mv squared. The nearer I get to that, the more the electrical forces start slowing me down. So my kinetic energy drops, but the potential energy of electrostatic repulsion grows so that the total stays the same until a moment when I momentarily come to a halt and then am ejected out again. So what Rutherford did was thought about the moment you come to the halt. He said, at this moment, there's no kinetic energy at all. It's totally the electrostatic energy, the product of the nuclear charge, my charge, divided by the distance between us. And then he just used conservation of energy. He said, when it was far away, it was half mv squared. At the moment it came to a stop, it was charges over distance. Do the higher mathematics of taking that at the top, that at the top, that then at the bottom, blah, blah, blah. Work it all out on the next page. To show you what it was like in those days, for the younger member of the audiences, that is known as long division. And you can see, and it's at that moment he discovers this distance of closest approach. Now, that, of course, is not the size of the nucleus, but it's a measure of where the positive charge lives. Was about 10 to the minus 12 centimetres, 10 to the minus 15 or so metres, which is incredibly small. And that was the moment he realised it was concentrated in the middle. And you can see his excitement, that his writing becomes almost illegible, even before I've erased it in yellow. But he says, since probably radius of atom is of order 10 to the minus 8 centimetres, it is seen that distance of approach to charge centre is very small compared with the radius of atom. No, the is very small, that's the bottom of the third line there, is being written so quickly it hardly leaves the horizontal line. So you can actually see the excitement of discovery at that moment. And you realise what a genius, to just focus on the ones that bounce straight back. Then he gets Geiger and Marsden doing all the experiments that we set to students because we know they can't answer the question in less than 20 minutes and things like that. So students, you get something out of this lecture. That's the way to do it in one line. So that was the discovery of the atomic nucleus. Scale the thing up 60 or 70 years later and have a beam of electrons that are 3 kilometres long, blast them at a target of protons in hydrogen and have a huge detector to see what happens. And you can detect what we now call the quarks inside. And that is a picture of the beam on the bottom left at Stanford in California. The target is hidden behind this bunch of concrete here. That is the detector that was used, and that is me. Or it was me in 1970. That's why the hair is still there, that you can't see it. But that's to give you an idea of the scale of things. Rutherford's experiment was done on a benchtop. This is using 3 kilometres of beam and a huge detector. That's what's involved in getting into the heart of the proton to see quarks. But you have to interpret things. We now know from that experiment that the proton is made in the simplest way of three quarks glued together. And to interpret that experiment, it was only possible because of Bjorkane's insight that the experimentalists had taken the data, they hadn't got a clue what it was saying. It was like somebody throwing a pot of paint, like some abstract art, on the paper. And Bjorkane said to Kendall, well, try doing it this way. And they did, and suddenly everything fell into place. And if you don't appreciate, if you don't believe me that Bjorkane was critical to this, go and read Henry Kendall's Nobel acceptance speech, in which he compared the shock that he had when the data fell into place following Bjorkane's idea to it was like discovering the Balmer formula of atomic physics all over again. Or as Bjorkane said to me more prosaically, Henry freaked out. So we, from that, have a concept that the proton is made of two up quarks and one down quark. The quarks carrying positive two-thirds and negative one-third charges. They don't look like that, at least as far as we know, but that's an artist's conception. And here is a not-to-scale picture of the hydrogen atom. A negatively charged electron on the outside, and these three fractionally charged quarks in the middle, cleverly conspiring their charges so that the total charge of plus one on the proton manages exactly to counterbalance the negative electron on the outside, which we take for granted until you think about it. Isn't it amazing the electron, which knows nothing about quarks, has just the right amount of negative charge to balance the charges on the quarks that have conspired to group in threes with these fractional charges so that there's no electrical charge left over, so that as we breathe, our hair stays in place rather than going up and down for electrical repulsion. So that is a hint of unification, and I think it's not overstating it that we know that there has to be some profound unity between the electrons on the one hand and the quarks on the other, but precisely what the nature of that unity is still a completely open question. And I'm not sure that the LHC, unless we have something totally unexpected, is going to give any great insight into that. But there we are. So this then is the situation with regards to the quarks and the electron, the seeds of matter. The up and the down quark, the electron, and a final character, the neutrino, emitted in radioactive processes, are the basic seeds of everything that we are made of and we're aware of around us. For some reason, nature has been not satisfied with that and has repeated it twice over with charm and strange quarks. And I haven't shown you the top for a reason that will be apparent in a minute. And bottom, the electron has two further versions, mu and tau. The neutrino has three versions. These versions are all identical to the first set, but for one thing, their mass. That was the mass of the top, if I was using those circles to give you an idea. So what we have here is, empirically, that the basic seeds of matter, the quarks and the electron and its friends, generically known as leptons, have a profound similarity spoiled by mass. The basic difference between the charm strange in the first set or the top-bottom in the first set are the masses. So first clue, mass is the thing that gets in the way of perfect symmetry for the particles. The same thing is true, we now know, of the basic forces. The three, apart from gravity, of which I have nothing to say, the electromagnetic, weak, and strong force that glues the quarks together are, we now know, also seemingly very similar. Quantum electrodynamics, the force, the theory that describes electromagnetic forces, is transmitted by photons, the quantum bundles of light, which have no mass. The glue that glues the quarks together, we now know, is very much like photons. They are little quantum bundles of something else, which have no mass. And the weak force, thing that's famous in beta radioactivity, is also transmitted by little quantum bundles called W plus and W minus, for W for weak, and a third one, Z0, like New York, so good they named it twice, Z for zero and zero for zero. The mathematicians here, that the rules that describe these are identical in all respects except for some technical difference. U1, SU2, SU3, apart from that, all the same. These guys use these facts to make their beautiful theory, but the W plus, the W minus, and the Z are very massive. So apart from the mass, again, you have a beautiful symmetry in all the forces. So that's the bottom line. The particles beautiful symmetry except for mass. The forces are transmitted by things, beautiful symmetry except for mass. The problem is that to create a theory without infinity, you didn't want any mass, but nature's got mass, so how do you get the mass in without screwing everything up? That was the challenge, and it was eventually solved. And that's the story as to how the credit should go and how it works. So, first part of the story, the people who realized that SU2 and U1 was a way to bring electromagnetic and weak together, if you shut your eyes to the mass problem, were Weinberg and Glashow at the top, Ward and Salam at the bottom, and to remind you, Ward missed out. That's quite a cause célèbre in physics as to whether he was airbrushed from history. Well, he was certainly airbrushed in one place. Here's a picture of Ward on the left and Salam long ago, taken by Dave Jackson, for those who care about these things. If you go to Trieste, the international center that was founded by Salam, you will get there sight of his papers, which I shall show you in a moment. And you also will get a little brochure that tells you about the laboratory with a picture of him, and there it is. I'll just go back again. There we are. Right. Okay, so that is a literal airbrushing, but that's probably a bit unfair. What I want to do next, though, is to show you some very interesting papers there are in the archives there. To start off with, here are two letters. It's not very bright, unfortunately. There's a bulb missing in this, but this is, first of all, a piece of evidence to note that the two letters are written by the same hand in that the P in the top there can be compared with the P in the top there. On the second line on the right, the I can be compared with the I just there, and the M here can be compared with the my in that box. Those two letters are written by the same person. There's no question about that. Let's just look at the left. It doesn't work. It makes people seasick. Well, anyway, you don't have to read this, but I will just tell you. It says it's addressed to Bengt Edlin, who is a professor of physics at Lund and a very influential person on the Nobel Committee, or at least he was back in the 1970s. My colleague and head of department has told me you are on the Nobel Committee and that he has nominated another colleague of mine, another colleague of ours, Professor A. Salam. I know you will detract from what a colleague writes, but truth must be told, etc., etc. The letter on the right, which was written by the same hand, Paul, I think that the same letter should go to Halton, blah, blah, blah. And the bottom here, it is signed Abdus. So Abdus Salam has actually written a self-written nomination letter on the left describing his work as if it was written by a third party. And then Paul Matthews, his colleague, has sent it in on his behalf. I'm not saying this is the first or the last time this has happened. It's just unusual to find the things lying around. But what is interesting about it from a more historical sense is this. If I highlight the next bit, and remember, this is Abdus Salam writing about himself or his colleague. So this shows you what Abdus felt was his important contribution at that time. And this is 1971, 72, 73, 3 years after the discoveries that ultimately led to his Nobel Prize for something else. Salam's greatest contribution is no doubt the modern theory of the neutrino. And for those in the know, the self-nomination cited the neutrino and parity violation. Salam was always convinced that in discovering what's known as gamma 5 symmetry, that he was able to explain why the neutrino had a zero mass, and he always believed that he'd been overlooked for the Nobel Prize on parity violation, which Li and Yang made, in his opinion, an empirical observation, whereas he had a theory of it. That, however, of course, we now know is somewhat specious, given that neutrinos do not have zero mass. But historically, it's interesting that at that stage and sometime after, and if you look at the papers in Trieste, you will see very clearly, he believed that his work on the neutrino was the significant thing. And only as things developed did it become apparent to him that actually the weak and electromagnetic unification was the way that the future lay. As a result of which, it was for the weak and electromagnetic unification that 5 years later the prize was shared. But why Ward wasn't included, well, you'll have to read the book at some length to see that. That's not just a promo, it's a statement. It'll be too long to tell you. But my opinion is that I think Salam was lucky to share in the prize with Glashow and Weinberg. I think he certainly merited a Nobel Prize for the collective things that he did, but I think in that case he was lucky, not least because Ward and he had worked together on pretty well everything that was involved up to that point. So what is it all about now? The whole question of the Higgs and everything, because there's a huge amount of confusion about this, in my opinion, but the basic ideas are much more common than people realize. And one of the reasons why I started writing the book was I felt that all this money was being spent on the LHC, but I hadn't seen anywhere anybody really try to describe what all this symmetry breaking was all about, what the Higgs boson is and why we should care. So that's what I, in part, tried to do. So let's try and investigate that, and then we will see why there's a controversy about to burst, I think. So from palaces to particles and galaxies to gluons, that's poetic, okay. So the idea of symmetry is something that we all intuitively find appealing, and you take a picture of the Taj Mahal and you immediately know what symmetry is. But we're interested not in symmetry, but in asymmetry, things that are not symmetric. And there are two ways that things lose symmetry. One which we're very familiar with, when the symmetry is not there in the first place. This is a picture of the front of Peterborough Cathedral, my own hometown. And at first sight, it looks symmetric on the front until you look behind the front and you see there's a tower on one side and there isn't a compensating tower on the other side. Now, of course, there's no reason why there should be a compensating tower on the other side. But you immediately begin to ask, why not? The moment you see asymmetry, you want to understand why. I mean, the answer may be the money ran out or something like that, but that's an obvious form of asymmetry, and it's not the one I want to explore. The one I want to explore is the subtle one called hidden symmetry, which is what all the excitement is about, or spontaneously broken symmetry. Here's a nice example of it, of a spiral galaxy. Why that's an example, I will show you in a moment, but this is like a metaphor for where physics is heading, the key to structure for fundamental particles and the forces of nature. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean this. Gravity between two particles depends upon the inverse square of the distance apart. It doesn't care which direction they are. Gravity acts in all three dimensions uniformly. So from the symmetry of things, you'd expect gravity to lead to spherically shaped objects. Well, in the case of the Sun, that's a pretty good approximation. And in many galaxies, you get spherical galaxies. But a spiral galaxy clearly does not exhibit the fundamental symmetry of gravity, which is all three dimensions equally equivalent. If, however, you go and look at the universe at large, you'll find that the spiral galaxies that do altogether cover all three dimensions, some this way, some that way, every which way. So in the universe overall, the fundamental three-dimensional symmetry is there, but individual spiral galaxies spoil it or hide it. A more prosaic example is water turning into snowflakes. Above the melting point of ice, you could look at the surface of water and the molecules inside it can be anywhere they like, in all the way around the circle. But when they freeze, you get this nice six-fold structure, which at the molecular level does not respect the full rotational symmetry. If you have a complete window of snowflakes, you will see that some are pointing this way, some are pointing that way, some are pointing every which way. So the collection of all of them remembers the fundamental symmetry, but each individual one breaks it. So that's the basic idea, and then it leads to questions like, are there other examples that we're more familiar with? Well, yes, there are some times that symmetries have to be broken, otherwise desperate things happen, like which side of the road you drive. And as I've just arrived from England, and my mind is following later, a thing I have to remember. In the world at large, it's not quite true, but you know, in the world at large, left and right pretty well roughly balance out. But country by country, you've got to make a decision one way or the other, otherwise there's total disaster. And in fact, I showed this slide in a different context a few years ago in a talk, and I asked the question, you know, why is it that they drive on the left in England and on the right in North America? And this kid put his hand up, like, me. Is it because the steering wheel's on the right in America? And I know you want to know the real answer. It's associated with the fact there are more right-handers than left-handers. People who are right-handed tend to lead with their left leg and vice versa. So there are more right-handers than left-handers. Imagine 400 years ago getting onto a horse. If you lead with your left leg and then you swing your right leg over onto the horse, you head off on the left-hand side of the road. and the peasants who don't have horses have to go on the right. So the natural side is the left. The French Revolution then did away with all of the fancy stuff that the highfalutin people had, and the peasants took over. So that's why when I said revolutionaries, and the theory fits right, that explains why the US of A, that misguidedly left the UK years ago, why Canada got the wrong side. That is simply because the border would have been a hell of a place to be, wouldn't it? But anyway, I've woken you up. I've got to wake myself up. Okay. Life itself is left-right symmetric. I mean, our DNA all spirals the same way. Interesting question, if there are aliens out there, whether theirs would spiral the same way or the opposite way. But there are reasons why, I suppose, it is handy, to mix a metaphor, that DNA all spirals the same way. After all, you know, it's difficult enough finding a partner anyway. Imagine having found your partner if their DNA was spiraled the opposite direction, end of procreation. So it is much more efficient for procreation for everybody's things to behave the same. So that at least is an example. But the origins of these are subtle. So why and how? So that really brings us to the next bit, how nature manages to hide symmetry. And here is the famous example of Buridan's ass, which, as you can see, is an engineer's drawing of a perfectly symmetric ass exactly halfway between two identical bunches of carrots. And now, Buridan was a philosopher in, I think, the 14th or 15th century. The sort of things that philosophers worry about is, if I had this perfectly symmetric ass exactly midway, clearly it would not be able to decide whether to take the carrots on the left or the right. Therefore, it would starve to death. And everybody laughs, because you know in practice that wouldn't happen. But then the question is, but why wouldn't it happen? And of course the answer is, oh, some small little bit of asymmetry, maybe a puff of breeze or something or other, would make it choose one or the other. The symmetry would be broken, and then you would have on one side an empty bunch of carrots and a happy ass, and the other side a bunch of carrots that's not been eaten, but the ass would survive. So some small accidental perturbation causes a big effect, you know, a living ass rather than a dead one. Let's move it up one stage to get nearer to where I'm trying to get to, is if you go on a very expensive cruise, you will be invited to the captain's table, and, or if you go to an Oxford college, this happens all the time, and you will find, you will find they've carefully laid it out so that between you and your adjacent person is a table napkin, and the question is the one on the left or the one on the right your table napkin? And until that symmetry is broken, the meal can't begin. And then, of course, what happens is that there is one person on the table who's more aggressive than the rest, grabs a table napkin, and you get a wave of napkins being grabbed, and away you go. This does have a realistic example. If, instead of just thinking of six or eight people, imagine we had a table with 100 people on it. And so up the top there, this person picked the napkin on his right, causing a wave of right napkin grabbers to come around here. But down here, you pick the one on your left, causing a wave of left napkin grabbers to go around there. And what will happen is that up there, you will suddenly find that you've got two table napkins to choose from, and down here you haven't got any. And so we will have two what's called domains of left napkin grabbers and right napkin grabbers. This analogy is realized in like metals, which are magnetic. The individual little atomic magnets are jiggling around all over the place at high temperature. As the temperature falls, two of them, which by chance somewhere or other are moving slightly slower than the average, manage to lock their magnetism in. And that then causes the magnets to sort of all go that away. Over here, maybe they locked in a different way and went that away. So you get what's called domains of magnetism in a metal. So this analogy is actually very real, and it's seen a lot. What about shopping trolleys? We experience it all the time. You know, you try to push your shopping trolley and it gets a mind of its own. It always keeps going to the left or the right and things like that. It, on the average, goes to the left in Sainsbury's and to the right in Tesco's and like that. You know, but from place to place, you never know which way it's going to go. What is happening? What is happening is that you have a situation where you're trying to push a trolley along the middle. That is symmetric, but it is highly unstable. The slightest deviation, and boom, it's gone that way, or boom, the other way. So what you have in general is a symmetric situation which is highly unstable, whereas the stable situations are unsymmetric. So you begin to get the sense now, that little wobbly thing, you can imagine that for real. A ball balanced on the top of a hump, and the slightest disturbance and it will drop one side or the other. And you can try to do Gedanken experiments imagining that, could I make it very precisely engineered so it would be able to balance there forever? No, because room temperature would make the molecules bounce around a bit and it would end up one way or the other at random. Could I do it at zero temperature, absolute, so there's no random motion? No, because the quantum will stop you doing that. However you try to do it, you will end up having to go one way or the other, but you can't predict which. If you do the experiment 1,000 times, it will go this way as often as that, but from time to time, it goes one or the other. You're giving up symmetry and metastability for stability and asymmetry. That is the common feature of all of these, and it is the nearest I can get in an analogy to what is going on with trying to build this theory of the electromagnetic and the weak interactions. The problem being, remember, the electromagnetic interaction was transmitted by photons, which are massless, and in the real world, the weak interaction is transmitted by W particles, which are massive. The idea then is to start off pretending that they are all massless. You have your perfectly symmetric theory mathematically with them all massless. But it turns out, in the sense that I'm trying to draw the analogy, that is highly unstable. The theory is more stable if one of them has a mass and you drop into the asymmetric stable configuration. That was the idea, but the moment people tried to implement it back in the early 60s, they ran into a problem, which I will not go into the details of, but you can chase it if you're really interested. That little drawing I was giving you like this, well, you've got to really draw it in all three dimensions. And think of that as a real hump with a ball on the top of the hump, which could then fall under gravity in any direction, down to the bottom, here or here or here, anywhere around it. And Jeffrey Goldstone showed that the possibility of rotating that ball from one place around the base to another corresponded in field theory to the presence of a massless particle which doesn't exist. It was called the Goldstone boson. And so this nice idea of using this picture to start off with symmetric theories and end up with asymmetric theories was deemed not to work. And for several years, people were trying to find loopholes in the Goldstone theorem, which says you can't do it. And eventually, the loophole was found in 1964, and it is known as the Higgs mechanism. Except it isn't the Higgs mechanism, because Jerry Guralnick, among others, had also been looking at this. So now I will come to, we're getting to the nub of the things now, the actual marriage of the electromagnetic and the weak forces, and how Ward missed out for the first time. So here we are, 1964, with this rather bizarre situation. Salam and Ward have been playing around mathematically with the idea that you can bring electromagnetic and weak interactions together in this SU2 and U1 mathematics. They haven't got an idea how to get mass into this, but who cares? For the moment, they've found the SU2 and U1 part of it. Meanwhile, in the very same institution, Imperial College in London, Jerry Guralnick and a colleague have been interested in how to get mass into theories by breaking the symmetry. But he knows nothing at all about SU2 and U1. And one day, Guralnick and Ward had lunch together. Now, the critical thing is that John Ward was quite a, I think paranoid is overstating it. He was very suspicious. Didn't like to talk about ideas. And Guralnick was a quite young person at that stage, and Ward was quite senior. And having the lunch, and Guralnick wanted to get a conversation going, and he started talking to Ward about what he was doing. And Guralnick, in his memory, was about to tell Ward about, oh, he was working on how to get mass into theories by breaking symmetry. And Ward said, stop. Have you written this up? And Guralnick said, no. Don't tell me any more about this, because if you tell people about your ideas before you have formally published them, they will steal them from you and write them up for yourself. So Guralnick stopped telling him about how to get mass into theories didn't ask Ward what he was doing, but, you know, had Ward not interjected at that moment, Guralnik with the mass mechanism and Ward with the SU2 cross U1 could have shared the Nobel Prize themselves. Who would have heard of Salam, Weinberg and Glashow? And who would have heard of Higgs and all the rest of them? But that is not how it happened. And if you read the book, you'll find that is not the only case in history where little accidents like that have occurred. So that's how Ward missed out for the first time. So there's the gang of six, of which Guralnik I've just mentioned. But now, of course, this raises another question. If, indeed, Guralnik has already solved this early in 1964, how come everybody's hearing of Higgs? Very interesting, as they say. And this is indeed interesting for many reasons, of which I can only really just cover one today. That was in 1964. It was in 1971 that the Toft and Veltman finally managed to create this wonderful theory that quantitatively describes how electromagnetic and weak forces, quantum flavor dynamics, works. And they did so by using the SU2 and U1 picture on the one hand and using the mass-generating mechanism of the gang of six on the other hand. And the fact that when they did those things together, they were able to create a theory which quantitatively works, I think, is the reason why particle physicists today are so sort of convinced that there is something to this. Even though we haven't found the Higgs boson yet, whatever that is, because I haven't mentioned that, really. Okay. So they used that idea and showed the whole thing worked. That was 1971. It was at that moment that the world suddenly woke up to this possibility, and within the next 3 or 4 years, we started hearing about the Weinberg-Salam model. Now, that was when I started in physics. I remember hearing about the Weinberg-Salam model. I'd never heard of J.C. Ward until after this was all over. I hadn't even heard of Glashow until the last moment. But anyway, that's how it was. 1971, these guys got the world excited. Weinberg, who had been part of these ideas early on, then wrote a paper. Given that Toft and Veltman showed the idea worked, Weinberg then updated his earlier paper to incorporate some of the new ideas and really show the great possibilities that could lie out there. And this paper is famous for many reasons, but one of which is one that I don't know that many people realize. I didn't realize this until quite accidentally it was pointed out to me. The Gang of Six in Weinberg's famous paper, here are the references to them, and you can see Peter Higgs's paper. Well, first of all, it shows these people published within a few weeks of each other, completely independently, the same idea of generating mass. Peter Higgs, PhysRev Letters, Volume 12, blah, blah, blah. Broughton Ongler in Belgium, PhysRev Letters, Volume 13. These three, PhysRev Letters, Volume 13, a later page. So there you see it in Weinberg's paper, Higgs first, Broughton Ongler second, these three guys third, all in PhysRev Letters. If you go and look at another great publication, which is the particle data tables that are produced every year or so, you see again these three. But if I flick back and forward, see if you notice the difference. PhysRev Letters becomes Physics Letters in both cases. Now, how has that come about? The answer is neither of these sets of references is correct. The correct is a hybrid mix of them, and it's this. And I've now got them in temporal order. That Broughton Ongler published in PhysRev Letters, Volume 13. In fact, here's the dates, I think. They published in PhysRev Letters, Volume 13, on the 26th of June. Peter Higgs published in Physics Letters, Volume 12. It's a totally different journal. Happens, by chance, to be almost numerically the same, but actually is a month later. And then Guralnik, Hagel, and Kibble published in October in PhysRev Letters. So that is the actual order. So I think that, just jumping back to, Weinberg's highly referenced paper is one of the reasons, I think, why Higgs' name got in first. But don't get too excited, because that is far from the end of it. So that is the Gang of Six. Those papers are the ones that showed how to generate mass in a relativistic quantum field theory. And the Sakurai Prize has been given to the Gang of Six for the discovery of how to do it in relativistic quantum field theory. There's no dispute about that, I think, at all. So we now come to the nub, which is the excitement at the moment, looking for the Higgs boson, or as Peter describes it modestly, the boson that's named after me. So let us remind then the historical order. This is the order of the papers that discovered what we call the, what I call the mass generating mechanism. There's no dispute on this. What about the boson? Let me flick back and forwards. There's no mention of the boson in Higgs's July paper, but in this later paper on the 31st of August, there is. But that's still in front of these other guys. Let's see what they all say. If you go and look at Brout and Ongler's paper, they didn't mention the boson at all. I asked them why not, and he said, we thought it was obvious. We didn't mention it. Now, actually, they came from a condensed matter background where these ideas, in a different context, were sort of obvious, and they were there showing for the first time how to apply them in the world of particle physics, which is not their area. So they didn't mention this further thing. The whole focus at that moment was, how do we get around this problem that Goldstone has found? And they had all found how to get around it. That was huge excitement. They've solved that. They don't mention any other stuff because it was obvious. Who cares? Peter said to me, I agree, it was obvious, but he mentioned it. Guralnik, Hagen and Kibble, if you look at their paper, they sort of do and they sort of don't. There is an equation in their paper which corresponds to what we would call the Higgs boson, but it has got no mass and it is not the thing that we're really interested in at all. So it's implicit, but they don't really mention it. That the only one that actually directly mentions it is Peter Higgs. So I now come to the final bits, which is the LHC quarks, the bosons, Goldstone and Higgs, whatever, and who deserve the prizes. And so this, at the end, will be very slightly more involved, but you know, if you're still awake, you can take this, hopefully. So this is as hard as it gets. That's the picture we had, the ball at the top, which can roll down the slope anywhere into the rim. The problem that Goldstone had had was the ball can be anywhere around the rim, which is bad news. And rotating the ball from one place to another in quantum field theory corresponds to the existence of a particle with no mass at all. That was what was known as the Goldstone boson. For those of you who know, it was actually first discovered by Nambu. But it was known as the Goldstone boson. The Gang of Six then found that if you had force-carrying particles like the photon or the W and Z around, it is possible for them to, quote, eat up the Goldstone boson and gain a mass. That is the mass-generating mechanism. They had solved how to get around the fine print of the Goldstone boson and give masses to force particles such as the W and Z. Wonderful. They deserve the Sakurai Prize for that, no question whatsoever. So where's the Higgs boson? Well, it's this. There are three dimensions in this. You fall the ball from the top of the ground. You can rotate it around the base, which is the Goldstone boson, or it can wobble up and down the base. And the wobbling up and down the base, which is like the radial mode, also corresponds to a boson in this simplest model. And that is the one that only Peter Higgs drew attention to. And that is the one which is technically what we would today call the Higgs boson. Interesting in passing, if you go back to Jeffrey Goldstone's paper in 1961, you will find there he uses this little model himself, and he has an equation of motion for the radial one as well, which is identical to the equation in Higgs's paper. And I sent Goldstone an email while I was writing the book to say, it seems to me that what we call the Higgs boson is already implicit in your paper of 1961. Now, those of you who know Jeffrey, he's not a man that commits himself very fast. He's only written a handful of papers in history, all of which have been remarkably fundamental. He only writes when he's absolutely sure. And he wrote back to me and said, that's an interesting question, I'll have to think about it. So 6 months later, I'm beginning to get the deadline pressing on sending the book in, and I sent an email back, say, Jeffrey, are you still thinking about it? Because I've got to the publishers. And he sent a note back saying, don't say I'm still thinking about it. I think it's possible that you are right, but I want to stress that was not the thing that was interesting to me. I was interested in this other one. So an amazing thing about wanting to avoid credit. But anyway, there we are. Only Higgs drew attention to it. Even that, however, is not the nub for me, because Brout and Ongler are totally true. It is trivial. Everybody who knows in quantum says you can't localize the base of that hat perfectly. There's always going to be a little bit of fluctuation. That's well known in condensed matter. I think there are people here who can probably correct me. I think that in condensed matter, the motion around the bottom are known as like spin waves, and the wobbles are called magnons. Is that right? Nobody said opposite, so I'll take it as being. So to those people, it was obvious. But that itself is not the issue. It's this. That's the Higgs... Oh, let me just go back. It was 1966, 2 years later, in this paper in Physical Review, where Higgs added one further thing, which is that a massive boson, we'll call it for Higgs now, can decay. And the way it decays will test whether this is indeed the way that nature does it. And so if the masses of quarks and the electron and the W and Z are really due to the mechanism, which the Gang of Six discovered, it's the decays of the boson that will test and prove this. That is why I think for particle physics, this boson is important, so that we can see whether nature really does do it this way or not. So to end, just a few quick pictures of, here is the underground view by an artist of a Large Hadron Collider with beams of protons zooming around here, coming smashing head on into this artist's conception of the Atlas detector. I'll just show you this to show how spurious these things are. So first of all, here's an artist's conception of the Atlas detector where a collision is taken in here and blam. Does anybody know what these things down the bottom are? They look like sort of garbage containers that are sitting there, who knows what. Anyway, that's the Atlas detector, which hopefully will be one of the things that gives us the answer. There is a little, I will use this on this occasion, that is to show the scale of a human compared to this whole thing. There's this famous photograph of the Atlas detector that one often sees all over the place, but actually there's no detector there. You know, that's a lot of air tubes and things as the beginning of it. The detector today fills all of that, but it does at least give you an idea of the size of the whole thing. And then finally, there's another experiment called CMS, and that's Peter's picture standing in front of it, which just reminded me of Alfred Hitchcock's famous statement that, you know, he was the first person to show sex on the screen when the train was entering the tunnel, and looks at that as if that's... anyway, let's move on. So, to conclude, where have we come? Nature seems to be built upon the idea that there's an underlying symmetry which is spoiled by mass. That in the case of the forces, the electromagnetic weak and strong forces seem to read the same mathematical rules, but with mass getting in the way for one of them. The fundamental particles that build things seem to be the same, except that mass is the thing that is distinguishing them. And these people have said that if you believe everything that Weinberg, Salam, Glashow and Ward did on the one hand and the Gang of Six did on the other hand, we can build a theory quantitatively which works. Therefore, we think that this must indeed be something to do with what nature is doing. But to be knowing for sure whether it is, these people indeed showed mathematically how it can be. But to know if it really is, we have to discover the boson or whatever it is and see if its decays do work. So how nature actually does it and performs this magic, only nature knows for now, but we soon will, hopefully. And what I just wanted to end with the last slide is that if and when this answer is finally found, there'll be huge publicity, but none of this would have been possible had it not been for Bjorkane's discovery of what we call Bjorkane scaling, which identified the quarks, the paradox of how quarks can be apparently free of one another and yet grip together, led to the modern discovery of quantum chromodynamics, which has won Nobel Prizes for Gross, Wilczek, and Politzer. It has led to the whole design of experiments which have brought us to the Large Hadron Collider, the analysis of which will depend upon the ability to think of protons as bags of quarks and gluons, all of which depended upon Bjorkane's insight back in the 1960s. And I think that if there is an unsung hero of this, it is him. So that is the end of the talk. If you want to know more about it, go and look at that website. And please do not make the comment upon the fact that the author's photograph appears to be rather younger than the author, because as everybody knows, if you go to a university and ask them to give them the photograph of somebody, they show you the photograph the day the person was hired. So that's it. Thank you.